You're listening to A Light at the Other Side, where we're sharing stories of resilience, healing, and hope. We share the experiences of adoptees, domestic violence survivors, military veterans, and more, so some episodes may contain potentially triggering accounts of trauma. To fully appreciate the light, we must sometimes peer into the dark. On today's episode, we're going to talk about the unique time period when an adult child is just on the precipice of moving out. Just slipping through my fingers, the gradual separation of mother and child when the hourglass is running out. Sometimes I feel like we're speaking two different languages, or perhaps parallel speaking right alongside each other while simultaneously missing the message. Sometimes we drift by each other, sharing few words other than polite greetings. We don't fight, we don't argue, we don't bicker, we just coexist most of the time. I sense with his restlessness that he's nearly ready to fly the nest. How can he possibly? He's not ready. There's so much yet to teach him. And yet, perhaps, I need to let go. I've kept my finger on the pulse of everything political, economic, etc. for my entire adult life. NPR is on in my kitchen, my bedroom, and my car. There have been ups and downs during my adult life. I distinctly remember both gas and milk being well over $4 a gallon when my children were babies and toddlers. It felt like we had made a huge mistake bringing kids into the world when the economy promptly plummeted. At the time, however, I was in the military, had great benefits and health insurance for them, so I did feel a little insulated from some of it. We did lose a ton of our home's value when the housing bubble burst. We were struggling to ensure everything in our little household was covered, but we were making it. The financial pressure eased up a bit, and we had some years of relative prosperity. My wages straight out of the military service were great, one of the highest salary packages I've ever had in my life. So even though the work was long and tedious and often outright boring, I appreciated the pay. More years passed and more fluctuation. I left the government job, worked elsewhere for a year, then stayed home with the kids for a year and a half while I went to college full time and had side hustles galore. I babysat, I baked cheesecakes and cakes for restaurants. I wrote a little guide on childcare for other military moms that I sold for $5 a pop. So that, along with my GI Bill monthly stipend, was still bringing in decent income. A decade of nonprofit employment followed, and the economy rippled throughout, sometimes making my meager pay feel pretty flush, and sometimes making it feel like never enough. I could never, and still cannot, predict the economic future with any degree of certainty. I always ride the wave and do my best. Through all the fluctuations out there, my goal was to keep our lifestyle as stable as possible for the kids in our home. I largely cooked at home as healthy as I could. I took them on little adventures, local museums and parks, comic book stores, just anything to get fresh scenery and something to invigorate the mind every once in a while. The times when my then husband was deployed were, I believe, the best. It was just me and the kids. We lived in an isolated bubble filled with pancakes, popcorn, and movie nights, picnics in the park, and afternoons at the playground. I didn't have to spend lots of money to keep them happy. And as kids do, they grew. We moved a few times. Every time we moved, I stayed up until the wee hours for the first few weeks, unpacking boxes, setting out family photos, hanging pictures and curtains, and making it feel as much like a home as quickly as possible. I didn't want them to feel like they were living out of boxes, so I made sure that didn't happen. As hard as I tried, forces were pulling against me constantly. My oldest son's extended family, my ex-husband, the ghost of my childhood trauma, the expectations of my workplace, the pressures of being a working single mom in recovery from abuse. So my oldest saw the most of it. He was torn between two families, trying to mask at both places to appease everyone, even after he'd been told he didn't have to do that at home. He felt the weight of multiple adults' grief and pain almost constantly. I enrolled him in gifted classes to keep him challenged. I got him therapy. I tried to normalize his childhood to the extent that I could. He played every sport under the sun, at least for one season. He was in theater and musical productions. And once a year, we had a special tradition. According to the schedule, every other year he was with his grandparents for Christmas. Sometime near Christmas every year, a big blockbuster movie came out, usually Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit or a Star Wars movie. We made it our thing to go see that movie together every year. Frequently, it was the night before he went to his holiday visit. We continued this tradition for 8 years. We didn't have a lot of time for just us. He was the oldest and his siblings came shortly after him, so I was busy changing diapers and nursing when he was a toddler and preschooler. During his elementary years, he was kept busy with activities and I was burning the candle at both ends and some in the middle as a working single parent. I never got enough sleep, much less quality time with each child. All those years just slipped by. We moved back to Virginia and I was working from home, which provided me more time with all the kids, but I was just in time to miss him. He was 14. His friends were way cooler and more important than me. And then a pandemic swept across the globe, and that winter, the theaters were closed. For the first time, we had no way to go on our annual movie date. I mourned. It didn't seem he noticed. The thick of the pandemic was such a dark time for our family. Each of us struggled individually, and we all collectively struggled. Bickering and outright fights among siblings raged frequently. They were home all the time, isolated from their friends, confused and scared about the general state of the world, and I was plunged in the deep end of postpartum depression and a general existential crisis. After years of go, 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 keeping a bright face on and buoying everyone's spirits around me, the light in me was turned off and I was sinking. I grabbed help and I pulled myself up, but it took so much effort that I wasn't able to be that force for my kids. I watched as he struggled, the usual adolescent search for self, experimentation with alcohol and weed, teetering on the brink himself. I pulled myself out of my own hole just in time to grab him back from his. I took him to his doctor and told him to be honest. We faced down hard facts. I got help for him, but it was evident there was no more me, we. It was him and me. We faced down hard facts. I got help for him, but it was evident there was no more we. It was him and me. And most of the time, he versus me. Part of this was normal adolescent behavior. Part of it was eternal and ever-present grief from the death of his father. Part of it was the pressures of being the oldest and having been on this ride with me the longest. Part of it was the pandemic and the immediacy with which it plunged everyone into dark isolation. It was a perfect equation for implosion, and he was imploding. I knocked on his door day after day, pulling him out for dinner, to watch TV with the family, to go outside. He complied, if mostly unenthusiastically. When schools opened back up, it was just in time for his senior year. He joined the drama club and starred in a couple of productions. He made some friends. He squeaked out the grades he needed to graduate. I watched him walk across the stage and hoist that diploma high, and I thought, okay, we've made it. It's surely uphill from here. I cried at that moment because I felt a sense of accomplishment for both of us in getting there. We had discussed his roadmap for the upcoming year the weekend after his 18th birthday. He had already decided to enroll at the local community college. It seemed we were on the right track. And then things became derailed. When he graduated high school, he had an older car he had purchased. He had a part-time job. He enrolled in college courses over the summer. He opened his own adult bank account that wasn't student checking. He went on a trip to a music festival with his friends. It felt like things were clicking. And then they weren't. First, the car's engine went kaput. Then he dropped out of the college classes. His use of recreational marijuana increased. I watched him, and it's dawning on me that I'm not the one with the answers to this. I may have taken him as far as I can go on his journey. He is now adrift, feeling his way, and he doesn't need or want his mommy to help guide him anymore. He needs to find the wheel and navigate his own life. The universe keeps sending me messages. I mean, to the point where it's inescapable by now, and it's not just algorithmic suggestions. I randomly turned on the radio in the car and heard an interview with a man who said he also floundered until he was 20 and moved out of his parents' house and realized, in his words, "I couldn't become a man in my mommy's house." I skimmed an article with similar sentiment from a man who had to leave his mother's house at 19 because he just felt stuck, and once he left, he instantly felt better, even though he struggled, and pulled his life together in a matter of months and now owns several successful businesses. I thought the most compassionate and helpful thing I could do for my young adult children was to provide a roof, rent-free housing, until they got their first couple of years of college under their belt and got on their feet. What didn't occur to me is that this dynamic doesn't work for everyone. For some young adults, it's not a help, it's a hindrance. It's tying them down to an environment in which they can't grow. They need a change of scenery. They need the ownership of their own place, and they need the responsibility of achieving their own little goals, buying their first set of sheets, eating their first burnt dinner because they really don't have any other food to eat, reaching over and realizing they do have to buy toilet paper on a regular basis or they're screwed. In my quest to help, I fear I may be doing more harm than good. Our relationship has begun to sour a bit. I'm familiar with the term soiling the nest as an allegory to older teens or young adults becoming difficult to live with as a way of breaking the close ties of the maternal relationship so they can leave the nest with less sentimental overtures on both sides. I thought perhaps this wouldn't apply to us. I think I was wrong. My son didn't want to leave his first nest. He was inexplicably 2 weeks overdue. I was huge, miserable, and tried just about every old wives' tale trick in the book to evict him from my womb. Spicy chili finally did the trick on a brisk November Sunday while we watched football. And yet it took another 18 hours of labor to wrestle this kid from me. He came kicking and screaming, wanting to be back asleep in his dark familiarity. I feel the same is happening now. Part of my reticence to pushing him out of the nest is all that lost time together. I mourn the years that trickled through my hands while I worked, sometimes 10, 12 hours a day to make ends meet. The times he asked me to come sit down and play with him, put together Legos, and I had to do other things. Did I? Could I have told my boss no, I wasn't going to work at home? I felt I couldn't, but perhaps I could have. Regret is the most perpetually aching wound I've ever felt. And now I'm out of time. I ask him to do things now, and he says no. He has other things to do. But does he? Or does he just not feel a connection and doesn't want to spend awkward time with his mom? I've reached a point where I have to set this down and admit that I've done everything I can. And while a lot of it wasn't perfect and was wrong and could have been done so much better, it's done, and there's no redos in life. I've read other mothers' accounts of their child leaving home, and I thought perhaps they were overly attached. They seemed so sentimental and so unbelievably sad. And only now, like so many other things in life, I get it. We never truly get it until we're there. We're standing at a unique crossroads. I fought for this kid my entire adult life. I literally fought for him in family court when his father's side of the family tried to get custody after his dad's death. I have fought for his education, his space, and his autonomy. My instinct is to keep fighting for him, but this time I'm fighting him, which lets me know this isn't the answer. I have to let go. This is the single biggest test of parenting I am coming to realize. It's not the sleepless nights nursing and changing diapers. It's not running around like a madwoman getting them to multiple practices, rehearsals, and school events. It's not even wrestling the bear of adolescence with them. It's placing all of that, all of those years of work and mistakes and missteps and love and best intentions in a package in their hands and letting them take what you've given them and do with it what they need to. In my case, I had to dump basically all of it. I had a crappy childhood, some good intentions woven into years of abuse and trauma. I had to spend some years plucking out those good intentions and gifts of education, opportunity, and culture, and then discard the rest. I had to take what from my childhood, what served me, what edified me, what was positive for me, and learn to process and dispose of what didn't. He has to do the same, and I don't think he can do that here. I have to wrap it up, put a bow on all of it, and give it to him, and then push him out the door to appropriately process it. I have 1,000 worries, concerns, and fears for him. I also have the excitement and vague jealousy, if I'm being honest, of seeing his entire life spread before him as a blank slate, ready and waiting for his creation, a big, giant, blinking cursor in the sky. And I'm standing here, watching him, waiting to see what he's going to create, and he's standing there, watching me, frozen. I need to turn my eyes away so he can begin. And the biggest person standing in my way is me. Love can support, enrich, and empower, and love can smother. I've taken small steps back. I've removed my fingers one at a time from his affairs. He knows the door is always open, and the washer, dryer, the fridge, and always Sunday dinner awaits him whenever he wants to come by. But shortly I'll be opening my front door and forcing him to push play on his own life. It's going to be the hardest thing I've ever done. What he has left to learn clearly can't be taught by me. I'm savoring the last bit of time with him under my roof. I try to hug him every time he passes and not linger on thoughts like he's too skinny or are those dark circles under his eyes. I try to encourage him to eat with us whenever possible so he gets some vegetables and real food. I try not to show my disappointment on my face when he politely demurs. I turn back to the stove, cooking for my other children, now pondering the special kind of agony that awaits me as I do this 3 more times. Mother's hearts must be built to last because mine has felt like it's cracking for a few years now. But for him, I have a smile and a hug. Chop, pour, stir. Try to not let tears drop into our dinner as the last rays of the sunset stream through the window. Tomorrow will come, and another after it. And my tomorrows will no longer be his tomorrows. And somewhere deep down, I know that's okay. Adrift, the spaces in between. Letting go and holding tight, the precarious journey of being a mother and wife. My phone buzzes, and when I pick it up, I see an incoming photo message. It's from my oldest son, a photo of his signed lease. A 2-bedroom apartment near downtown with his best friend of 6 years with affordable rent and all utilities included. I am thrilled for him, excited that he's starting this journey and relieved that he found such an opportune place to springboard into his adult life. And I feel as if my heart is falling out of my chest. There were months where I felt I couldn't cry. I kept focusing on the next task, the next item on my checklist, building my podcast, helping gather resources and information for my middle son's case with the DOJ, hosting Sunday dinners, running around to annual doctors and dental appointments and checkups, and I felt numb. I awoke some nights, 2 or 3 a.m., put on my robe and wandered my house. I looked at the framed photos, my children through all ages and stages, senior portraits hung on the wall beside birth announcements, bookends of childhood. I wandered through the kitchen, picking up a soda can left on the hutch and tossing it in the recycling bin, mildly annoyed but becoming hyper-aware that the days of cleaning up behind these burgeoning adults are rapidly flying by me. There was a particular trembling inside me, but no tears. And now it seems I can't stop. I go to the bathroom many times a day now, frequently to dab at my eyes with a cold washcloth and breathe in through the nose, out through pursed lips, the trembling in my chest almost violent in its fervor. I've stopped wearing mascara unless it's waterproof. Perhaps the reason many women love quilts so much is that they intimately resemble our hearts, pieces of everyone we've loved and shown love to, and little snippets taken from each journey, patched together pieces of life, sewn delicately with our labor. Holiday dinners, birthday parties, washing sickness out of sheets, holding cool washcloths
to feverish heads. To be a mother is to be broken down and rebuilt 1,000 times over, to watch pieces of your heart break off and go walking around the world, driving off in a car, moving across town to a 2-bedroom apartment facing the water. It's so good. It's good to see him take this step. I'm so grateful for it. And also I hate it and I can't stop crying. To be a mother is also to be a bit of a control freak. Even in the healthiest families, moms are typically in charge of so much. We know everyone's schedules. We make and keep appointments. We taxi around everyone to each of their commitments. We check grades and attendance to make sure everyone's staying on track. And then one day, it must stop. I have to bite my tongue when I want to ask more questions, and instead, I smile. I try to muster the same vibes as when a good friend is telling me something and respond from a place of friendship, not momness. I pour so much into my children. I can't count the school commute lectures where I would blather on about the importance of timeliness, having our homework done, respect, treating others with kindness, because I wanted those morals to come from me, not some cartoon or television show. I never knew how much they absorbed, yawning in the back seat, rolling their eyes when I caught them in the rear view. I wasn't crazy about imparting life lessons this way, but with work, after-school activities, and sports, sometimes that time in the car in the morning was the biggest chunk of time I'd have with all three of them all day. A captive audience, literally. But more than anything, more than the lessons, I wanted them to know they are so deeply loved. That a mother who deeply loves takes raising her children seriously, so she talks to her kids about the important stuff instead of ignoring or refusing to address it. I also had some modicum of control over their decisions. When they asked if they could go over to a friend's house, and I knew the friend's parents were engaging in some not so appropriate stuff in their home, so I had to say no, I had to take the anger. I had to be the bad guy. When I said no to going out too late in their early teens, when I had to ground them, take away their phone, and they lashed out with their words, I had to absorb those little slices. The first time one of my children said, "I hate you," it took my breath away. It made a sharp, searing lightning go through my chest, and I had to step back and step away, pinpricks of tears behind my eyes. It felt deeply unfair. I raised two of my children almost entirely alone. Their father was deployed the majority of the time we were married, and when he was home, he was unpredictable, volatile, and violent. So when I finally had enough and ended our marriage, he took off thousands of miles away and has kept his distance ever since. Every sickness, every bad day, every celebration, every sleepover, every ride to school, every single day has been on me. I've had to be good cop and bad cop. I've had to be nurse, chauffeur, cook, party planner, housekeeper, tutor, disciplinarian, and friend. I've had to give away all of myself. So when the children come of age, when they no longer eat at home but eat out with friends or throw a frozen pizza in late at night, when they begin packing their baseball trophies and honor roll awards into cardboard boxes, I find myself adrift, lost, without anchor. I don't know exactly where I fit in his life now. I want him to always come home, Sunday dinner, holidays, whenever he needs anything or just a cup of coffee and a talk. But I no longer have any control over that. I just have to wait and see if he chooses it. There's a show on Peacock. I won't spoil it, but there's a scene in which a mother of adult kids talks in very descript and raw words about what it means to be a mother, to give up every ounce of who you are for people who frequently, it seems, don't even see you. And by the time they're grown and you've poured everything into raising them to be good and successful people, you realize that the you anticipated returning to, she's gone. Somewhere along the way, she died. So you mourn not only the loss of those little babies, but the loss of yourself, the dreams you had, the person you were with more energy, more vitality, the youth you spent caring for others instead of chasing your dreams. It is a choice, of course. Many people don't choose it. And I will never, ever say that they're selfish. I know many women who would gladly choose motherhood, and it was never a choice presented to them. I am so richly blessed that my body was able to give me 4 healthy children. But as the three older kids begin trickling out the door and I find myself with a bit more time here and there, time to return to myself, I don't know what I'm looking at. And I can't take my eyes off the baby packing his boxes, his long dark curls hanging over the chocolate brown eyes that transfixed me from the moment he was laid in my arms. 2 decades ago, I was just starting to show, my belly forming a smooth, small bump that I would proudly show off over the summer in a white bikini dotted with cherries. Now my belly lies sagging and empty, a wrinkled shell that reminds me daily of the physical pieces of myself I've given in the journey of motherhood, a bumpy shell I cover with flattering cuts and spandex. But what have these children given me? They've given me life. They've given me humility and perspective. They've given me maturity and self-reflection. They've given me love and endless abundance. They've given me purpose, a purpose far greater than anything I could have ever dreamt for myself. Years ago, I wanted to be a famous writer. I wanted to write books and be on the New York Times bestseller list and be interviewed on talk shows. I thought being interviewed by Terry Gross on NPR's Fresh Air would be the absolute pinnacle for me. Now, at 42, I look at what celebrity does to people, and I want no part of that. I look at what wealth does to families, and I wonder if I even really want that. I want to write, but I also want it to touch people. I want my words to unlock words for others, for them to be able to access their experiences and process them in written form, journaling, essays, poetry, songs. But now, more than anything, I want my children to soar. I want their lives to be good and rich and deeply fulfilling. I would trade in every word I've ever published if I could secure good lives for all of them, in a minute, without a second thought. I look at my dink, dual income, no kids, friends, vacation photos on Instagram, a trip to the Amalfi Coast, crystal clear blue waters, luxury suite, glasses of champagne. I think of the weekend trip my husband and I took, scraping together enough coins to drive down to the Outer Banks and get a reasonably nice Airbnb for the weekend, eating seafood and then walking on the beach, taking pictures of the full moon over the pristine sand, holding the hand of someone who gets up every day at 5:30 and heads to 2 jobs, one after the other, working to ensure that all of our needs are met and many of our wants as well. I hold his rough, sturdy hand and I find such strength. Not just physical strength, but the quiet faithfulness of texting his children every day when they're not in our home. Showing up to every single softball game, concert, recital, and event after working all day. Being a consistent, steady presence. Being human. Falling and picking himself back up. Committing and recommitting to our family again and again. Neither of us was designed to be childless. I would be an absurdly neurotic mess and honestly probably wouldn't have made it this far, and he may have drowned himself in alcohol and bad choices. Our children force us to be better, to focus on others, and to get out of our heads. We still stumble. We still mess up. I'm still a bit neurotic. He still has to fight his demons. But we fight together and with a common purpose. And that's easy when they're kids and it's fun, when board games and beach days make them smile and their happiness is but an ice cream cone away, when a surprise ticket to an amusement park would yield shrieks of, "Oh my God, thanks, Dad." Now their eyes are past us. They're sliding around us, reaching for their own lives and futures, and we find ourselves looking around for a foothold. We find ourselves adrift in this phase of parenting. I packed up 5 containers of leftovers after I made a big meal that no one wanted to eat. I smile and say, "No big deal," as little tears ripple through my paper heart. He asks if they want to play a video game, and when they demur, I find him in the back patio in the dark with a cigarette and a beer, a bit sad, a bit lost. I'm even adrift as a wife. I can't reach him in this place. I'm keenly aware that a father's role is different in ways I can never imagine. He's spent so much of his children's lives in an office, earning for them, working for them, taking so little for himself, it's maddeningly difficult to get him to buy so much as a new pair of pants, and then to be burned by their rejection when he reaches out. I can't fathom his pain. Some days I can't stand the sight of the walls of our house and I yearn for an escape while he loathes the walls of his office and yearns to be home. We yin and yang our way through this, leaning on each other, leaning away, slipping and reaching. In a society that doesn't really value families, in an economy that keeps a truly comfortable life just out of reach, we are fighting upstream for one purpose and one alone, for our children. And then they pack up their boxes and they leave. Midlife crises are common, but I have to imagine that for parents, they're so much more explosive and searing. I frequently compare parenting to the growing of the Chinese bamboo tree. You plant the seed, you have to water and tend to the soil, make sure it has nutrients, but it does not grow above ground for 5 years. For 5 years, you must pour water, nurture, weed, and wait. If you've done a good job, on the 5th year, the bamboo will burst through the earth and can grow 90 feet in just 5 weeks. It's remarkable. And it's exactly like parenting, only stretched out over much more than 5 years. We pour everything into our children. We help them pack their boxes. We move them into their first apartments or dorm rooms. And then we wait. We wait and wait. We watch them falter. We watch them make some bad choices and some good ones. We watch them try on different personality quirks for size. We watch them love and then be tragically hurt by love and then cautiously love again. We watch them and we hope. We hope that one day they will begin to grow as their own fully actualized people, confident in their choices, comfortable in their skin, and really ready to take on the world. Part of the most pointed agony of this is trying desperately to impart the wisdom you've gained through pain, the life lessons you've learned the hard way, wanting so badly to spare them the same hurt, only for your words to fall on deaf ears and then watching them experience it anyway, despite your warnings. The awareness that the wisdom you've gained through trial and error, pain and success, is not yours to gift to them. It was life's gift to you. And now their lives must gift them their own wisdom in many of the same ways. We learn through pain, through loss, through regret. Our children cannot learn through our pain. That's not how life works. Sometimes my husband and I talk about our oldest children, their missteps and mistakes, and our words just trail off and we just hold hands. We just find anchor in one another as we watch them drift. We've done all we can. So we turn our attention to their younger siblings. We continue to parent. We continue to show up and we continue to hold our feelings deep within as they each begin to soil the nest in preparation to fly away. In 50 years, I will be one with the earth and no one will remember a thing I wrote. I seriously doubt I'll ever see my name on a New York Times bestseller list, and Terry Gross will most likely never be aware of who I am. But there will be 6 people walking the earth who will recall my words sometimes. Perhaps when loading laundry, a reminder to wash with cold water. Perhaps when planting their garden. Perhaps when discussing politics. Perhaps when baking a cake. Perhaps when holding their first grandchild. And my most fervent wish and desire is that when my voice flickers through their mind, they will smile. That's all. The legacy of a smile is where I drop anchor. When life's storms toss my children about, when life gets hard and rocky, I want them to be able to come back, to find their anchored home, and find rest and love and reprieve. But also, I want them to sail. To lands unexplored, to adventures beyond the horizon, to unfurl their sails and allow the winds of life to carry them on their own glorious journeys. And so I must let go. We'll always be here, but their life, it's out there. I examined the lease, noted every addendum, and discussed it with him. All the I's are dotted and T's crossed. He's asked every pertinent question and found satisfactory answers before signing. And so this weekend, I will help him carry boxes. I will probably leave some food in his fridge and an extra pack of toilet paper in his bathroom. Then I will walk out of his front door, get into my car, and drive back across town, where I will drop anchor, releasing him to sail boldly forth into the horizon. I appreciate you tuning in this week for this sentimental journey. My oldest child is leaving the nest and moving into his own apartment tomorrow. And I'm very excited for him, but obviously this has been a very emotional journey for me as well. And I hope that other parents who have been in similar places or are coming up to this period in their life can somewhat identify with my words. I'm very excited that I will be sharing the words of someone else next week. So you get to hear someone's perspective, viewpoints, and stories other than my own. So that's very exciting. For episode 3 of season 2, I'll be beginning to share the works of others. I'm going to wrap this episode up with a little advice for my son, a little life advice for all of my children. And I hope you'll tune in next week. My advice to you as you fly the nest. 1. Be a man of your word. Do what you will say you will do, honor your commitments, and be honest when you cannot. Communicate. Talking about something is always better than not, even when the conversation is difficult. It's more difficult to repair something that has festered. 2. Don't be led around by the nose by material stuff. If you want something, put it in a virtual cart for 1 month. See if you still want it after you see what that money did for you over that month. If you still find it to be that important and it fits comfortably in your budget, get it. But get very comfortable telling yourself no. 3. Pay yourself first. Even if it's just 5% of your income, put something aside for yourself every time you get paid. Harness the power of compounding interest at your young age. Put some cash in a high interest account and leave it alone. Forget it exists. Set it on auto draft to sync with your paydays and forget it. 4. Be kind. You never know what someone's going through. Sometimes it's easier to be kind to strangers and not those closest to you when they irk you or get on your nerves. Be the kindest to those who have chosen you. Put them first. 5. Guard your heart, your space, and your wallet. Be cautious and discerning who you allow in your life and in your physical space. When someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time. You cannot fix anyone but yourself, so don't try. When you are kind and good, certain people will seek you out to take advantage of this kindness of spirit. Never allow anyone access to your finances, and be extraordinarily discerning who you allow into your home. This isn't mean or rude, it's healthy boundaries. 6. Never lose the awe and wonder for the beauty around us. Make sure to get plenty of time outdoors. Go to the beach, botanical gardens, hiking, kayaking. Sometimes the best meditation is time to yourself outdoors, breathing fresh air and moving your body. Put your phone in your pocket and go on little mini adventures to enjoy the place where you live. 7. Make sure to get some time alone. You cannot fully develop as a person without solitary time. You are still early on this journey of getting to know yourself. Make sure you're not cheaping out on yourself. In that vein, consistently be on a journey of self-improvement. It truly never ends. You're never too old to learn or change, so continue to be open to opportunities for growth. Learn and listen with a sense of humility. You don't know everything, and you never will. 8. Always make sure you have toilet paper. 9. Have a check-in every month with your roommate. Yes, even if that's your spouse or partner. Go over finances, what bills need to be paid and when, and have a frank discussion about any gripes, grievances, or misunderstandings. Don't let it build up. Once a month, just open the floor for total honesty to make sure you're both good with the living arrangement and both pulling your weight. 10. You set the tone for how people treat you. Do not tolerate disrespect. There needn't be drama or a scene, but just quietly cut contact with people who consistently disrespect or seek to harm you. If they inquire why, calmly let them know and give a reasonable opportunity for them to correct the issue. If they don't, proceed as you were. You don't owe anyone your time, energy, attention, or affection if they aren't treating you well. and yes, that includes me. Focus the time you have here on people who reciprocate your love. 11. Come home for Sunday dinner. I want to see you. I want to know you're eating at least one home-cooked meal a week. And you need to keep your seat warm in this family, to remember where you came from, to stay connected with those who love you most of all, and to remind you where you're going. You will always be wholly and unconditionally loved in our family. Your siblings will miss you far more than they will ever admit out loud. So show up for them and for you. Those relationships will last even beyond me, so nurture them. Be proud of yourself. I sure am. Now go and fly.